So I'm going to do a brief introduction to the next few verses of the 8 mind training verses. I'm a bit ambitious. I'm going to do a recap, a very, very brief recap of the first 3 verses. So the first one is about cherishing others. So it's about transcending our innate tendency towards self-cherishing. And it's wishing to achieve true happiness for ourself and all beings as the wish-fulfilling jewel. The second verse is about systematically practicing putting others first, which is transcending our innate tendency to put ourselves first and to see others only in relation or primarily in relation to ourselves. The third verse is about being constantly on guard for the kleshas. So when we notice disturbance, which is a sure sign of a klesha, we deal with it. So that sets the scene. And then the next 3 verses are more specific. They're more applied. And they get harder. They're progressive. So if you think the first one's hard, it gets worse. And one of the characteristics of this work is that it's very counterintuitive, which is not surprising because it's actually countering ego clinging. So our natural outlook on life is to preserve our sense of self, our ego, at all costs. And what these verses are doing is training us in trying to see what happens if we do the exact opposite of what we think will make us happy, and to actually find out what happens if we do that exact opposite, if we take the risk, we take the plunge, and we find out what happens if we relinquish the ego. So in a sense, I would say these are spiritual death practices, and obviously when you have spiritual death, to some extent, you have spiritual rebirth as well. The fourth verse is, when I see ill-natured people overwhelmed by wrong deeds and pain, may I cherish them as something rare, as though I had found a treasure trove. So, ill-natured people, that could cover a wide spectrum of ill nature. It could be crude, insensitive, it could be angry, it could be really, really unpleasant. And it may not be directed towards us. They might be directing it towards someone else, or they might just be in a very bad mood. So how do we usually respond when we become aware of an ill-natured person? We tend to back off, we tend to recoil, we avoid them if possible. Sometimes we do that physically, we just skirt round them. Sometimes we take a kind of spiritual remove. We put ourselves above them in a sense. We don't interact with them, but we slightly from above have an attitude of something like contempt or disapproval of them. So in some way, either emotionally or physically, we remove ourselves, we separate ourselves. And we have a sense that if we do interact with them, they're somehow going to embroil us. We're somehow going to get caught up, affected by their ill nature. We might be dragged down. It might even be detrimental. It might be bad for our spiritual practice. So we have a sense of preservation, that we're preserving something by remaining separate from them. And it happens a lot, it's embarrassing, but we can even realise that we've taken a dislike to someone at first sight and we know nothing about them, but there's something about them we don't approve of, and we just decide that we're going to steer clear of them. We don't even make conscious why that is. And even with those slight avoidances, it's interesting to find out what happens if we do make connection, if we do come into contact with somebody who we just have a slight feeling of preferring not to come into contact with them. If we just put ourselves close to them, say something to them, interact with them, usually you find that any preconceptions that we've already created just dissolve away. So that's the sort of simplest end of this practice. And it does show us how limited our practice is and how strong our wrong views are, that we think we're practicing, but we still recoil and avoid other people. We actually need to be able to practice in relation to all other people. So when we get a sense of there being an ill-natured person, one of the things we can do is to reflect. This is a reflection that runs all the way through these verses. We remind ourselves that there might be anything going on. We have no idea why they're appearing like that. They might have just had a terrible shock. Anything might have happened. We don't know. But they're probably, it's pretty likely that however they are being is their way of dealing with however they are and whatever is going on in their life at that moment. So they have reasons, they have a whole rationale, a whole reason for being how they are being. We just don't know what that is. And we do that as well. So we need to remind ourselves that when we see someone looking ill-natured, they are suffering, and we need to have a sense that there's some pain involved in that, there's some suffering involved in that. And if we reflect on that, we can cultivate an empathetic, a sympathetic, connected attitude towards them. We have to be careful not to do this in a rather superior kind of way. But for example, this is always happening. Another small example: we come out of a lovely, we've been in the shrine room, we've been feeling great metta. We walk out of the shrine room, and our shoes have gone. And you immediately speculate you have a sense of who it was, how stupid they are, how unaware they are, and that's the usual kind of route we go down. But we could just reflect on what might have. There might be all sorts of other reasons for that. So whenever we come across someone who is suffering and we're experiencing someone as ill-natured, we get a sense that there's pain there, and we see it as an opportunity. When we feel that recoil, if that is what we feel, it's an opportunity to work against that, to turn it upside down, and to threaten our ego clinging by doing the exact opposite and moving towards the person, making contact, and usually finding out that there's a human empathetic connection that can be made. It's interesting that there's I think we often have an attitude that there's, on an event like this, you may find a sense of there might be one person, you might have a sense of there's one person in your community or on retreat who is being a bit of a problem by being very ill-natured. And if they could just go away, everything would be perfect. I caught myself doing this in the community at Tiratanloka, where, not surprisingly, there was someone in the community I found quite difficult. I worked on our relationship. I managed to turn it around. And there was a moment when I caught myself looking for the next person. And I realized that I had a view that there was always someone who was spoiling things. And that to try to have a view that it was possible for everyone to be in contact and feeling warm towards everyone was actually quite a challenge, and quite a challenge to me. So that's something that I've worked with. And as we practice, the natural progression of this practice should be that we encounter fewer ill-natured people. It's a miracle. They start to drop off. They start to vanish. The fifth verse is when someone out of envy does me wrong by insulting me and the like, may I accept defeat and offer victory to them. So this accepting defeat and offering victory is a very strong statement, and it's the statement that prompted Chikawa he set out to find the person who had come up with that phrase. He went in search of Lang Ritangpa. Unfortunately, Lang Ritangpa had died by the time he got there, but he studied with one of his other disciples, and he then composed the 7-point mind training. But this was the verse that prompted that search. And this verse addresses the subtle or not so subtle endless comparison between self and other. There's always comparison going on, and that leads to competition, and that leads to subtly just trying to make sure that we have the last word or we come out on top. So when it appears to us that someone else has tried to take us down a peg or two, do I need to translate that? Someone has tried to put us down in some way. Our instinct is to defend ourselves, to retaliate. We want to justify ourselves, and sometimes there's an added bonus. We manage to also slightly reduce the other person as well. So the question we need to ask is, what are we defending? We're defending our sense of self, we're defending ego. Because to a large extent, our sense of self is based on comparison, competition, how we are in relation to other people. Do they like us? Do they approve of us? Are we popular? Are we good at things that they approve of? Anything will do. Are we wiser than them? Do we know things? Are we right? All these things are ways in which we strengthen our sense of self. So when that is questioned or challenged, we actually feel we've been made smaller. We've even been negated. And we re-establish our sense of self by justifying ourselves. And we also have a justification in mind that it would be bad to allow the other person to get away with that. If they do something which is a little unfair, then if we just leave that standing, it's not only unpleasant for us, we think it's bad for them. It's not true. So there might be cases, if somebody has said something which is wrong in relation to the Dharma or another person, we might want to gently clarify our position. But if it's simply to do with us and our sense of self, we can take the risk of doing the exact opposite to what is instinctive and just consciously abandon the victory, give it to the other person. It's very, very difficult to do. It does need a certain base of psychological maturity and health. And there are complexities, for example, in India with a history of oppression. You need to be careful that you're not risking undermining a positive sense of human pride, which is so necessary. But if we're willing to drop our defences and let go, we'd sometimes find a sense of relief initially. In my group yesterday, a couple of us were talking about our investment in being right, and that when we're wrong, when we're patently, obviously wrong, and there's no going anywhere with it. There's a sense of relief that we're actually normal, fallible. You're not feeling protected for a while. So I remember doing a decorating job, and I prided myself on my painting. I'm quite a good painter, and I was running a painting team, and I had a terrible moment where I stepped back into the paint tray. And I remember the feeling of shock that I could have done such a stupid thing, and then a feeling of complete liberation. So it's worth trying, maybe in little ways to start with, trying to just let go of whatever it is we've invested in. Just abandon it. Just relinquish it and see what happens. See if it is devastating, or see if it actually is a bit of a relief. It also reminds me of the Dharmapada, the idea of opening up the thatch. If you take the roof off, then you don't have to worry about whether the rain is coming through. You just get wet. And even with other people, if we just allow other people to have their way, to be right, to be whatever it is, not to resist them, if it doesn't matter in that some other way... sometimes that does allow the other people space. It's as though, you know, when you go through a swing door, sometimes you go through a swing door and someone at the same time opens it the other way and you just go flying through the door. It's the same thing in some martial arts. So sometimes when someone is using a lot of force, if you just allow space and you just allow the force to expend itself, then they too may find that there's a space in which they can review whether what they were saying is actually really necessary or really true. The sixth verse is, even if someone whom I have helped and in whom I have placed my hopes does great wrong in harming me, may I see them as an excellent spiritual friend. So this is regarded as the hardest one. Dharmadina refers to it as, after all I've done for you. So after all I've done for you, how could you then do whatever it is you've done? So maybe someone who you've been a Kalyana Mitra to says something critical about you to someone else and it gets back to you. It's that kind of thing. Or it could be that another order member or even our teacher is not what we expected. They do something that we feel disappointed in. And we feel let down. We feel even betrayed. And we might feel quite disillusioned. It might be something that has an effect on us. But what has actually happened is that We've invested in something being a certain way. We've put an investment of our own. We've invested in another person or another, even if it's someone we've helped or someone we look up to who we've tried to be supportive of. So we've invested in some way in someone else, and it turns out they're not exactly how we wanted them to be. So actually we've had unrealistic expectations, or at least we've had expectations to the extent that when they're proved wrong, it's painful. So it could just be that we just note what happened and we learn from it and we adjust our view. That would be the most straightforward response. But in practice, we can feel much more let down, betrayed. And that does imply that we've invested, we've built something up into a certain way in relation to us. So we've got ideas about how they should be, how life should be. It's horrible when life does the wrong thing. There's something Subhuti refers to is there's an interesting time when people can feel betrayed by someone else when that person dies, which is quite extraordinary when you think about it, but people can feel let down, abandoned, betrayed by someone else who has left them by dying, which is just shows the extent to which we can invest in someone else being there in a particular way for us. So the real nature of people and things is that they're impermanent, they're unsatisfactory, they're not going to be exactly what we want and how we want them to be all the time. And so really this is reality just showing itself more clearly to us. And we need as well to have a sense of we're not completely dependable, reliable people either. We're all doing our best. We're all being what we feel will do the best. It's not always what will be best, but we're all trying, and we are all in the same boat in a way. And it is our point of connection with other people is that we are all in the same boat in that we're trying to find happiness and avoid pain, and we're doing it in whatever way seems best at the time. And quite often it's temporary, that what we do manage to achieve is just temporary. Sometimes it's just plain deluded and wrong. But that is the human condition, and we need to really cherish others and have this sense of unity, of connection with human beings, in terms of we all suffer from the human condition. We also need to work on forgiveness, that when we do have a sense of having been let down or disappointed, with that understanding of other people, we also need to be able to have a more complex, a more subtle sense of what we then expect. And with that goes understanding and forgiveness, and a lot more we have to have very high hopes in a provisional way, but we don't need to not expect things of people, but we need to really hope for the best, wish for the best, try to achieve the best, and also forgive each other when we fall short. And it's often people the people who we feel betrayed or let down by are the people we've invested in. So they are the people who are important to us. They may be our very close friends. And so these are our close friends. These are our teachers. These are the people who are our excellent spiritual friends, because they're real, they're human beings. They're reflecting reality and the human condition back to us. And they're giving us, that is our opportunity, that is our practice space. So these are our excellent spiritual friends with whom we practice. So I hope that some of the material in these three verses will have rung bells for people. I'm sure it will. Maybe not all of them, but maybe if everyone can get a sense of whether there's one particular point that's come out of these verses where you can relate to something that has happened, maybe recently, if you can relate to something where you could have maybe, you did take the sort of natural defensive response to someone else, and maybe you can just play with, would it have been possible to do something completely different? And just maybe even practice trying to imagine what that might have been like. Get a sense of, well, is that possible? And we can build up a... We start in small ways, but then we do build up so that when you see one of these potential moments lurking on the horizon, you see an ill-natured person, you hear that someone has tried to... You get the impression someone has been out to get you in some way, or you have a sense of someone having let you down. Those things then become prompts, and you remember, what was it I was supposed to do? What's the possibility? What's the possible alternative way of behaving in that situation? And maybe sometimes we'll just start to just try to do the exact opposite of what we feel is the most sensible thing to do. We just need to turn the tables, turn it on its head, and then find out what happens. And we can take this into our groups now.